facilitator, Jim Rice, from ICF. And so, Jim, I'll call your materials up, and please feel free to begin.
Thanks, Jean. And thank you all for joining us today. So, as Jean mentioned, I'm Jim Rice, and I'll be your session moderator. Looks like we have a pretty good crowd here today with about 200 or more from all across the country. We also have a great group of speakers who I'll introduce in just a minute. But first, let me just say a few words about this ORD webinar series. So the EPA's Office of Research and Development, ORD, has designed this series of webinars to explore some of the challenges that we face with working with mining sites and mineral processing facilities. For those who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm that helps inform the agency's decision making. The objective of these seminars is to both inform you, the practitioners and stakeholders, about all the tools, the latest tools and methods that are available, but also to understand your research needs. The webinars are designed to be interactive and generate discussion, just like you would at a technical conference. So, in light of our interest in getting your feedback, the speakers and webinar team have developed a series of interactive activities to get your input on these presentations. So, I've posed a couple of questions for your responses to get you warmed up to this idea. If you're logged on, you'll see a question like this at the bottom of your screen. So what I'd like you to do is use the blank space at the bottom of your screen to enter a word or a short phrase to answer these questions. There's two questions, one about where the mining sites you're working on are located, and the second is what are your challenges? Now when you see the challenges pop up, you might see a little button that says plus one. If you agree with that particular challenge, just click on it, and your response will be added to that response. And all the responses together will be ranked by popularity, so you can see what the most popular problems are going to be. I'll give you a minute to do that. There we go.
I see them coming in. So I've put a few in there just to get it started, and it looks like people have already caught the hang of it. So we'll start to see those results filter out. Remember, if you see something that you agree with pop up in the challenges list, just hover your cursor over the entry. There'll be a plus one that you can then click on to cast your vote and agree with that particular challenge.
Absolutely. So we can see from just the survey response we've already got that there's a lot of challenges, a lot of different types of challenges working with mining sites, including the types and distribution of sources, the size of these mining sites, interactions between surface and groundwater, some of the unstable conditions at these sites, and ultimately the high cost of cleanup that we often see. So to address the challenges, we have to find more effective ways to address mine sites all throughout the project life cycle. Like using innovative characterization or data management tools, we have to consider the emergency responses that can be very unique, things like wildfires and tailings dam failures. We also have to apply adaptive management strategies for effective remediation over the long term for these sites. So over the next several weeks, this series of talks is going to bring together a series of experts to explore these areas and explore the latest thinking we have. Your job as a participant is to listen, digest, and respond to all this information and provide us your feedback to help us better understand the research needs. So today's first session is going to focus on site characterization. Our first presentation is from David Williams, who will discuss remote sensing applications for mining sites. And he'll talk about hyperspectral and high-resolution imagery. And I'll use examples from Ducktown, Tennessee, the NASA imaging of the Mother Lode in California, and discuss potential application of high-resolution satellite imagery to monitor sites over the long term. Dr. Williams is a research geophysicist at ORD, and he specializes in remote sensing methods for characterization and monitoring. Next, we'll move from the air to the ground with Dale Workham's presentation on geophysical methods at mine sites. He'll discuss some of the traditional methods as well as some more innovative methods for assessing these large mine areas. Dr. Workham is a research geophysicist with ORD and performs basic and applied research on the geophysical methods and conceptual site model development. Robert Ford, also from ORD, will then talk about Some of the methods for assessing contaminant flux in groundwater to surface water pathways to support building better CSMs. Dr. Ford specializes in characterization of organic contaminants, and he's also responsible for the recent monitored natural attenuation guidance for metals that some of you might be familiar with. Kirk Shekel is our final speaker for this afternoon. He'll bring us down to the molecular level in his discussion of using lead isotopes and speciation to understand both source attribution and exposure risk. Dr. Shekel's with ORD, and he's an international expert in the application of synchrotron radiation techniques. So with that, we encourage you to actively participate in all these discussions, ask questions as you need, and respond to the various poll questions throughout the session. And if we're ready, I'd now like to turn the session over to our first speaker, David Williams. David?
Hello. Just waiting for it to come up. A little quick background. I'm with ORD. I've been with them since 98. I was in the U.S. Geological Survey building in Reston, Virginia for 6 or 7 years, where we ran a Superfund and RCRA remote sensing site assessment program that was called EPIC. That's now been disbanded, and there's a couple of us still around, and we've been doing this work for a long time. So I'm going to be talking today again about remote sensing for characterizing mine waste and mineralogy, mine drainage geochemistry, and site monitoring. So I will hit this button. Okay, so we all know the problem, and there's a beauty picture there of Ducktown, Tennessee. The problem is that we're concerned about the environmental effects of mining, and we know that the oxidation of the sulfide minerals associated with coal and hard rock ore deposits create environmental problems. I'm mostly concerned with the drainage waters with acid and high metal loads that causes loss of biodiversity, sedimentation, corrosion, and erosion. The problem is that the site assessment requires soil and water sampling, but that can be aided by remote sensing measurements. If we can survey a site from thousands of feet up in the air and find targets or materials of interest to us, we can direct further investigation by field crews. So just a quick overview of some remote sensing technologies. You know, in the past, we've had aerial photography. And from there on, we had coarse-scale remote sensing from Landsat. And recently, we have commercial satellites that have sub-meter resolution in the panchromatic that is black and white and a meter or so or higher in color. But making quantitative measurements from aerial photography, which is just 3 or 4 bands of information, or other satellites is difficult. So, and I know a lot of people in the audience are familiar with hyperspectral imagery, and I'll be talking at length about that. We use hyperspectral sensors to perform imaging spectroscopy. So it's like flying a lab spectrometer on an airplane. And we use spectral analysis tools similar to lab spectroscopy to analyze the ground surface. We also have access to high-resolution LIDAR, which is light detection and ranging, and SAR, which is radar using synthetic aperture. And everything I'm talking about today, we can talk at length at another time. You know, a lot of these things I'm talking about is a semester-level college class. So we will, anytime you want to talk to me about things in detail, just let me know. But the LIDAR and the SAR provides topographic information and some material characteristics, such as SAR can tell you grain sizes and some other characteristics about the soil. We have, again, multispectral imagers, and now there's a couple of satellites that have band combinations that are characterized specific spectral regions that are useful in land analysis, such as vegetation. So combining these, all these things together, which is the topic of a rare project for Region 9, we can combine imaging spectroscopy with topographic information from LIDAR and other sensors, and we can mine that data using what is now called machine learning, or AI, with basically algorithms to characterize the data sets and to derive information. So I want to get clear that in imaging spectroscopy using hyperspectral sensors, what we're doing is we're making actual measurements. We're not mapping features in a picture, which is what is done in multispectral imagery or aerial photography. So if you could, a little hand thing here, my green hand thing here. There he is. So your iPhone camera or Android camera has three bands generally. So that's not going to really get you much information when you look down below at what a spectral curve looks like from a laboratory. But a hyperspectral imager has continuous spectrum across the wavelength range. And from there, we can detect crystal field, electronic transitions, or in the IR, we can detect vibrational spectra. And that can be used to identify materials and minerals and vegetation and other things. So just a little selfless promotion. EPA actually owns a hyperspectral imaging system. We've developed it with NASA, and we fly it out of Langley Air Force Base. It has flown and is continually be developed. It's a small modular system that goes underneath an aircraft, in this case a Cessna, and we could also put on a larger aircraft and fly it longer distances. And there's a little bit of an example of what the costs are for something like this. And I know there's some controversy or controversy about using EPA funds for this, but that is being ironed out as we speak. So we're very positive about the future on that. So when we use remote sensing for mine site characterization, we typically go through a kind of a workflow. So we look at the current or previous sample collection, and we determine the geochemical regime of the site, such as is it acidic, high iron loads, high sulfur, or is it an arid system out west that has maybe high iron but low sulfur, and that kind of directs kind of minerals we're looking for. In an aqueous environment, we can model the precipitates coming out of a mining area using, these are probably for people that know what they're doing, these are old tools, but we still use them. So we can predict the minerals that we're going to be looking for. And then we use remote sensing to find these minerals using a process where the hyperspectral imager collects the data, and then we match it to known spectra, and we just do kind of a feature mapping system like that. So we combine the mineralogy and topography to map features such as waste piles, and then we can integrate hydrologic models that estimate rainfall runoff, and we can possibly model the existence of solids downstream and map fate and transport. So example number one is, again, the beautiful Copper Basin, Tennessee. We flew this site 1999 and again last year. So again, everyone knows that mine drainage precipitates come out in a pH regime. So I'm looking for things like schwartmannite, goethite, ferrihydrite as indicators of the effluent pH. So if we can find these minerals, we can, in a sense, back calculate what the potential pH of the water is and also some of the solute loads in that water. So again, in an imaging spectroscopy world, we take an image of the ground, and each slice of the imagery is a spectral band. So we build up this, what we call an imagery cube, and then we mine that data to detect features in that imagery. So it's in the NASA JPL concept, they take 224 spectral images simultaneously, And when we look at that, we can see characteristic vegetation spectra. Water has a very distinct flat signature in the blue, green, red. But then if there's some sediment in the water, you can detect a peak. Soil, relatively flat generally, atmosphere, things like that, we can all pull out of the imagery, and that's how we map materials on the Earth's surface. So minerals that we're looking for, like I said, we try to predict the things that we're going to look for in the mine area that we're looking at. So goethite, very common mineral that appears. It has a electronic field transitions in these wavelength regimes. So we can look at the spectra and find minerals or find materials that match this kind of spectra. Barytehydrite, which precipitates at a higher pH, doesn't have distinct electronic transitions in these areas, and it has a very kind of shallow absorption line around 1.0 microns. So we can separate, when we look at two different materials, we can separate these different minerals based on their spectra. So Ducktown, very interesting site. We both have more basic water quality issues where the barytehydrite tends to form. That's where the outfall from the high metal loads of North Potato Creek and Davis Mill Creek fall into the Ocoee and precipitate barytehydrite. But up the stream in these creeks, we have large amounts of schwartzmannite or oxyhydroxy sulfate, and those are really very common occurring minerals here. So another beauty shot, Davis Mill Creek. This was taken in 99. It's improved a lot since they've been doing work there. And these are the mines and the areas that we flew. This is actually a hyperspectral imagery all tied together and shown as a true color composite. But we flew this whole area, including the tailings pond, Berber mine, which is quite famous. That's where the visitor center is, actually. And Copper Hill area, where a lot of the industrial processes took place. So again, we look at a hyperspectral image. This is a in true color, obviously, but it's three bands of the 224 bands. But from there, we go in to the imagery and find spectra of interest. And then we could also do some ground truth using a field spectrometer to make sure that we're looking at the right thing and kind of validate what we're looking at. And over here at the Ocoee River, and we found a lot of barytehydrite, iron mineralogy deposited along the shores of the river as the high metal loads entered the water and precipitated out. So I'll show a little bit of that. Time is flying, my gosh. So when we run it through the algorithm, what we see is a faint orange material along the stream, but the algorithm can pull that out. So what we did was we took the spectra from the aircraft, matched it with some field and laboratory spectra, and then the algorithm finds that in the imagery, and what you're seeing now is not a hand-drawn, but a computer-based result that shows the amount of materials in the water, because every pixel in this imagery is tied to the Earth. We know the footprint size of the pixel. In this case, it was about a meter. So we can make a coarse estimate of the amount of material in the stream. And here is the waste retention pond. And here is the Ocoee River. Again, this is North Potato Creek, I believe. There's the highway, some mines, and again, the algorithm plucks out of the imagery the precipitates that have formed in the stream bed due to mining activity upstream, or the effluents coming out of the mine working. So the results, I'm just going to tiptoe through this because time is flying, but we found a fair amount of Schwartmannite, like I said, and really, you know, the pH of the streams can be estimated. It's a kind of reverse engineering approach, but knowing the minerals that form, we can guesstimate the effluent pH and do a estimate of the metal loads and ions in that water. So, like I said, we flew this in 2008, and this is just a notional slide of what we're going to do. Upcoming manuscript is take a look at the activity that occurred on or about when we flew the Imager originally, and look at the conditions then, and then look at the improved conditions. They've removed a lot of the workings. Some of the stream bed area has been remediated. The stream itself looks to be less heavily sedimentated, if that's the word. And the whole area, this is only a snapshot, but we can do a retrospective analysis to take a look at how the cleanup and how the environment has changed over time. So example two is Mother Lode, which is in California, and these are footprints of the aircraft imagery that was taken by Avaris group at NASA JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab. We flew, some people in the audience are probably very familiar with Avaris, and we also flew the Airborne Snow Observatory because it has a LIDAR system. So for every footprint you see here, we have hyperspectral imagery and high-resolution LIDAR to do the topography. So the objectives, I'm just going to step through this quick. We're going to try to detect and map arsenic-rich mine waste in the area, do field sampling, use the mineralogy and the LIDAR to predict off-site transport, and write a report. So I hope people can see this okay in the audience. This is hyperspectral imagery of Argonaut Mine, and these are selected samples. This is Argonaut Mine here. There's the retention dam. This is the waste tailings piles. So each, where the arrow is pointed, is spectra pulled out from the imagery. And what we're looking at is this spectral feature right here that's indicative of goethite or iron-rich material. And other materials in this imagery don't have this feature. So this is one of the ways we can exploit the spectra to map the materials. And a lot of people say, well, orange stuff looks the same, but it's not true because that's a baseball infield there, and it doesn't have the spectral feature that the iron-rich material has. So it might look similar to your eye, but in hyperspectral land, it looks different. And with the few minutes I have left, I'm just going to wave my hands at a few things. One is, there's been some interest I've heard about assessing mine infrastructure stability. So one way we could do that in remote sensing is to do SAR interferometry, where you take imagery from SAR satellites and do an interferometric comparison that can detect very fine movements of the Earth. So basically you're looking, this is a very simple way to describe it, but if you have two satellites and they're measuring the same spot of the ground and they're measuring the height at that same spot in the ground but at two different times. So by comparing the height differences over time, you can get a detection of actually movement. So in this picture, we show in the red, and you probably can't see it, but it's moved over 40 centimeters between the two image acquisitions. So it's slumping and moving, and that can be associated with potential failure of this flooding levee, flood prevention levee, looks like in the Sacramento Delta area. So I pitched ORD to do this. And maybe it'll happen someday, but this would be a great project. We have very, very good SAR satellites on orbit now, and this kind of work is done constantly looking at volcanoes and slopes in erosion areas, and it could be possibly applied to remote mining locations to look at, again, infrastructure changes. And since I actually do have a military and intelligence background, we have the idea now that we can do what is called persistent imaging. So that's taking remote sensing imagery and staring at it on almost a daily basis. So by looking at it at a daily basis, you can detect anomalies related to different infrastructure issues, such as, again, indications of failure in dams, breaches. We can actually model buildings and detect infrastructure changes, buildings that are expanded or been removed. And the bread and butter of my old group, which was waste burial and covering, you can detect using daily imagery as well. So the power of daily imagery is that you can avoid cloud issues because if it's cloudy one day, the next day, you know, the satellite comes right back over again. This is a kind of artist's rendition of what these satellites look like. They're staring down every day. They're going overhead, collecting daily imagery worldwide using the constellation of these nanosatellites. So, and I have less than a minute left. So if you go to Planet Labs and look at energy infrastructure page, you can see some of the examples. So here is two different pictures of the same mine, and you can detect mining activity between the 2 days, and you can detect what parts of the mine are working, or active, and what is inactive. And here is an Amazon shot of an Amazon mine. And between the 2 dates, you can see that there's been significant movement into the forested areas for the gold mining operation. It's just some examples. I'll leave it to you to come up with ideas that you might want to explore with this. But again, the power of daily imagery, or it's not hyperspectral imagery, it's color imagery, but if there's cloudy days or cloudy weeks, you can get by that because you're assured that once the clouds are gone, you're going to have an image. You don't have to request the images. They're taken constantly all day long, every day throughout the world. And unlike Digital Globe or some of the other providers that you have to ask to take an image, these are taken constantly. So you have a base map that's being updated basically every day. And that's incredibly powerful. So I'm out of time, and here's my contact information. If you want to have another briefing on the TARO system or the techniques used to analyze hyperspectral data or LIDAR data, give me a call. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. So it sounds like we have a couple of questions from the participants. And one of the participants apparently works on NEPA and CEQA assessments, that is, prior to the actual construction of the mine, looking at baseline conditions. So what do you think the applicability of this technology is to those sort of pre-mine characterization activities under NEPA or permitting?
So again, we get into the issue of data availability. If the mine is historic, then we have to rely on aerial photography. And my group at EPIC, Environmental Photographic Interpretation Center, that's what we did for a living. And there's lots of databases of imagery from the USDA and other groups. EPA has archives of imagery as well. So you'd have to look back in time in the imagery. It's color imagery generally, and do what is called air photo analysis, which is drawing things on photos and looking for pits and holes in the ground and things like that. If it's recent in time, then there is a satellite archive, and there might actually be, in some cases, more advanced imagery if it was within the last 20 years or so. So there might actually be space-based hyperspectral imagery for the site that could be looked at to look at pre-mining conditions, things like that. So it all depends on when it was done, where it was done, and the observables, whether, you know, some things are done under canopy or, you know, in the side of a mountain that's hard to use remote sensing for, but it all depends on the situation.
Thanks. So are you saying that sometimes the forest cover can obscure some of the attributes that you're looking at here for hyperspectral imaging?
Yeah, sometimes, especially out east. I've done a lot of work in coal mine areas where canopy closure from trees really obscures a lot of the dumping areas and a lot of the waste pit piles. So hyperspectral, any kind of imaging can't penetrate canopy closure or cover. So it's works great out west. In fact, the NASA and the USGS have a lot of their great work done in Nevada and places like that where we don't have to worry about vegetation as much. But out east, there's a lot of issues involved with vegetation obscuring things.
Okay. Well, thanks. If anybody has any additional questions, like to see you, just pop them into that box. I don't see anything coming up right now, Dave. So perhaps at the end, if we have some additional time, if more questions come up, we'll get a chance to answer them. Thanks very much for the great presentation. I'd like to move now to our second presentation on geophysics. Dale Workema, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks, Jim.
There you go. All right, Dave.
Not seeing the presentation come up quite yet. Oh, there we go. Okay, great. Thank you very much, Jim, and thanks, Dave, for a nice presentation from satellite imagery. What I'm going to talk about today, and I'm going to go right here to my outline, is I'm going to go through what are some typical mine waste investigation objectives where you might want to apply surface geophysical methods. And I'm going to get into why you might want to even use geophysics or what role it might serve to help solve those particular objectives at your mine site. And then I'm going to give some examples, just going through some basics of geophysics and how they can be applied to some of those objectives. And then we'll sort of summarize what I've talked about. So what are some typical mine waste investigation objectives where you might be interested in utilizing geophysical techniques or where geophysical techniques might be most suited to solve those? One might be if you're trying to understand the tailings pile or to characterize that tailings pile, like is it a saturated slurry or what's the thickness of that mine tailings pile. So I'll go through some methods on how you might be able to use geophysics to help solve those problems. Secondly, I'll go into some acid mine drainage applications, how you might use geophysics to help solve or use geophysics as one investigative observation to help answer some questions on AMD. And then sort of to follow along with AMD, if that's getting into the groundwater and then getting into a surface water body, how might geophysical methods be utilized to help in those investigations? But overall, whenever you're using geophysics at a site, what we want to do is really clearly define those objectives in order that we can pick the right geophysical method or the right geophysical tool for the task. And what we're primarily doing in geophysics and surface geophysics is we're mapping different physical property contrasts. And those physical property contrasts, depending on the objective, create an anomaly or trend or a hotspot that is different from outlying areas. So we try to find those areas. And the main objective is to use the proper tool for the proper task. And that's where I have this picture of a screwdriver. You want to use the right screwdriver for the right type of screw you have, and certainly not use a hammer for a screwdriver. So why would you even want to use geophysics in the first place at a particular site? So a good analogy is to look at medical imaging. And prior to any invasive surgery or If you have a problem with a joint or a bone, what you would typically do is maybe get an X-ray to understand the calcium distribution in your body and how it might be fractured or broken. And if that's not your problem, then you might get an MRI. Point is that you use a different tool for whatever type of investigation or what you're trying to solve. So prior to expensive earth intrusive observations like drilling or excavating or designing a remediation or capture system, we can utilize geophysical imaging to understand what's going on in the subsurface to pick the proper tool or to guide those future decisions. So again, what mine site investigations I'm going to go through is mapping that 3D extent of a waste pile, a tailings pile, mapping acid mine drainage, mapping the geology, which is sort of a traditional geophysical exploration, but understanding the geology and understanding that conceptual site model is really important to understanding the fate and transport of any groundwater that you're interested in. And then, as I said before, locating and monitoring groundwater surface water interactions. So also, geophysical surveys are very scale dependent. David Williams just told us about remote sensing from the satellite. Well, we can also use, and that's great for regional or large scale studies, airborne geophysics we can also use, which is great for like the watershed scale. And I'm going to be focusing mostly on ground surface studies, which is mostly designed for the site-wide or site scale investigations. And as you can see, a lot of those overlap a bit. But again, it depends on your objective and what you're trying to find. So if you're trying to map or understand the extent of mine tailing piles, the first thing we look at in geophysics is to try to understand the physical properties of those mine tailing piles. And how are they different from surrounding materials? Well, they're going to be unconsolidated. They'll have higher surface area. They'll be less dense and more chemically available for weathering. And those alter the density, magnetic susceptibility, the electrical conductivity, chargeability, and even the seismic velocity of that particular zone. So then we can determine which geophysical method measures those properties. So now we can determine, oh, I could use gravity to maybe measure the density contrasts and understand the thickness of that tailings pile or its lateral extent. So here's an example of gravity survey. So this is a picture of one type of gravimeter. Here's a picture of it being the data being acquired. And we basically can map and measure. In this case, we're measuring the interface between bedrock and the overlying sedimentary or underconsolidated materials. And if there's a good density contrast, we can really map that really well by just surveying and measuring the gravity distance or measurements along the surface of the Earth. We can do that in a lateral sense and an aerial sense here. And in this case, we can map a very large low gravity anomaly, which could be diagnostic of a tailings pile. And therefore, we can know its lateral extent. And we can even begin to model and understand its vertical dimension as well. We can also use DC resistivity. Resistivity measurements are where we measure the effective resistivity of the Earth, which is directly proportional to the porosity, how much of that ground is saturated in that pore fluid. And what we do is we put electrodes in the ground, we inject current into the ground, and we see how the Earth filters it out. And how it filters it out is going to be diagnostic of these properties over here, as I mentioned, the pore fluid. And this is a we can survey laterally and vertically, so we get a nice sort of 2D and image of the geoelectrical profile at depth. And this is actually an example of a landfill, but it's a good example that can be applied to tailings piles, where you can see there's a very large geoelectrical anomaly with this object here that has a lower resistivity relative to the surrounding environment, in this case shale and harder rock. So it's a good method to try to understand and map any alterations in the porosity in the fluid in the subsurface as well. We could also use ground penetrating radar, which is a great method. We can just drag and send radar energy into the Earth. This is a good example showing at depth Here we can see the water table. We can also see at depth where there's a big packet in the subsurface that shows disturbed soil relative to natural area. So this is a good example of beginning to understand where we might see an interface between two electrical property contrasts, which might be associated with the bottom of a tailings pile. Another objective we might be interested in is to map acid mine drainage and the groundwater plumes and their interactions. So again, what are the physical property changes? Well, AMD often has lower or altered pH, which can result in an increase in total dissolved solids, different chemical species, altered redox. And those geochemical changes can result in an alteration in the magnetic susceptibility, the electrical conductivity, chargeability, oxidation potential. And therefore, these are the corresponding geophysical methods that might be used to measure those physical properties that would then result from acid mine drainage. So here's an example of electrical resistivity. You can see up at the top, here's our conductive zone. So this might be a zone where we have elevated conductivities due to AMD. Here's another example of a conductive zone relative to sort of a layered geoelectrical zone where we have a higher resistivity at the surface. As we get into the saturated zone, it becomes more or less resistive, more conductive. So it's a good example of using electrical resistivity to find those conductive zones. We can also use GPR, and this is what happens with ground penetrating radar. In conductive zones, it actually attenuates or absorbs that radar signal, as you can see in this area right here, relative to the area outside. So this is that anomalous zone that we can use in geophysics to try to understand where we might have an increase in conductivity in the groundwater, which may be related to lower pH, increased TDS from AMD. Self-potential is another promising method, or actually relatively easy method, where we don't even induce an electrical current in the ground, but just measure the Earth's natural voltage potential. And this is an example of a really elevated groundwater conductivity plume, and you can really see that it has higher voltage relative to the area outside, and this is a site that we were able to revisit, and you can see that over time after this high conductivity groundwater plume has been remediated, that high chargeability is gone. So there's another method that could be applied for AMD. This is actually a picture on the right. Is actually a collection of some self-potential data at, right in an area where there was a plume going through this, or acid mine drainage plume going through that wetland. So the third area, or a third objective, is to try to understand the geology. We can use geophysics for a lot of mapping the geology in the subsurface. And this would be in from a mine waste perspective, to try to understand the fate and transport of that acid mine drainage and what controls its movement. Well, geology can cover that flow, fractures or preferential flow paths. So what we would be measuring is perhaps the remineralized fractures in the subsurface and the conductivity, or even the seismic velocity, and the corresponding geophysical method is there, shown in the table. So in this case, I'll show you some examples using seismic methods where we can induce a seismic energy into the subsurface, and based on the density, bulk modulus, and the shear modulus of different materials in the subsurface, we can measure the P waves and the shear waves, or the transverse waves, as they move through the subsurface, and we can understand the layering in the subsurface and get an idea of the different acoustic impedances and the geologic characteristics in the subsurface that might guide groundwater flow. We can also use passive seismic techniques. This is called HVSR seismic, where we actually measure with a little instrument like this here. We can measure the Earth's natural resonance frequency, and if we can compare that resonance frequency in the horizontal and the vertical sense, and if we know that shear wave velocity, we can then calculate the thickness of unconsolidated material over solid material. And this is a really inexpensive, pretty rapid method to try to map hard rock boundaries that might be governing groundwater flow. So here's an example of some of that work. This is collecting some shear wave data. Here's the results of the shear wave energy coming in, and we can see that we can plot the arrival of that S wave per distance of where the geophones are located, and we can take the inverse of that slope of those arrivals of the shear wave energy, and we can calculate the velocity in that upper layer. So in this particular case, we calculate the velocity as 270 meters per second. And then we can grab our H over V instrument. We can go, this shows locations where we just go around the site and put the instrument down, let it collect for about 20 minutes or so, and just we can just move throughout this whole site. We can calculate and measure the average resonance frequency. Here's that peak, like I showed you a few slides ago. We can take that frequency and plug it into that formula. We calculated the shear wave velocity. We can divide that by 4 times this resonance frequency, and we find that depth to the interface to be about 2 meters. We can do that throughout a site relatively rapidly to try to understand where that surface or that interface between, in this case, unconsolidated material and more consolidated material might be, to understand either maybe the thickness of that unconsolidated material, or to try to understand maybe there's some channels in the bedrock that might be governing groundwater flow. So in the last objective is to try to understand if and locate groundwater surface water interactions, where if you have acid mine drainage impacted groundwater, where would that groundwater enter a surface water body or like a creek or a stream, and what physical properties are likely to be different? Well, we're definitely going to have different pH, results in electrical conductivity, and temperature. So we can look at those different physical properties, look at the different geophysical method that might measure those different properties, and use that tool to measure that property. So some examples of that, this is using electromagnetic induction. So here's the instrument right here. This is a multi-frequency electromagnetic induction instrument where it sends out a primary wave into the subsurface, and depending on the electrical conductivity and the metallic content of the subsurface, secondary electromagnetic waves come back to the surface that are measured by the instrument. And the amplitude and the phase difference of that secondary wave gives us an idea of the subsurface conductivity. We can employ this method on the surface of the Earth, as shown here, just walking around, it's geolocated. Or we can also even do it on a water surface, and here's an example of using it on a little inflatable towed behind a canoe to try to understand the electrical properties below the surface water feature. So here's some results from that. So here's the results of this particular site I showed you a little bit before with that H over V data. We collected a bunch of data in different directions here and along the water. And what we can do is we can plot those data geolocated, and these data are contoured in terms of electrical conductivity. And you can see these sort of these ribbon plots because the instrument used was a multi-frequency instrument, so we got not only lateral data, but we also acquired vertical data. And you can see there's definite zones of variable conductivity here, which in this particular site told us an idea of the definite difference in thicknesses of overburden as well as potential higher conductivity groundwater flow, or in the surface water body, which is this track over here. We can see areas of elevated conductivity, which may be associated with differences in the geology or thicknesses in overburden or the introduction of more conductive groundwater. So we can see, you can begin to see zones that are of interest and might then guide the next investigation on this site to further understand how you might delineate if there's any groundwater surface water interaction or any influence of more conductive groundwater at that site. This is another example. This is some high alpine work, and this is surveying right along a stream here. You can see the data being collected there. This is the sort of Google Map trace of the data that was collected, which is over 2 kilometers. And you can see along the stream with depth, and these data go down to about five meters or so depth. You can see that there's definitely areas. Now, these data are in ohmmeters, so this is resistivity. So the blues are going to be more conductive or less resistive, and the purples will be less conductive or more resistive. So in terms of trying to understand where groundwater might be entering this creek over here, we can see what we want to find are the blue zones. So we can see there's areas of blue zones that, again, are either likely more conductive groundwater that might be entering the surface water body and or differences in geology. And this is on the other side of the stream, about 10 to 20 meters off the stream, so we can begin to see where different features might connect at the stream or maybe go deeper or shallow out. And so we can begin to get an understanding of if there's more conductive groundwater coming in, and we can correlate that with what we know about the geology to begin to understand, if these conductive features are either due to a groundwater seep that's coming into that or more conductive groundwater seep and or the geology at that location. This is another location. You can see here the tracks on the Google Earth map, the data being collected. You can see some of the mine infrastructure back there, old mine sites. And here you can see the data look completely different. They're much more layered. So we have a much more sort of a traditional geoelectrical profile. However, we still see there are some zones, some sort of anomalous zones that might represent, again, either differences in geology or they might represent groundwater inputs into the stream. The next level of investigation is then to start looking at thermal imaging. So if we look at the geoelectrical plots and we can understand how the geoelectrical images are changing, we can also use heat tracing using thermal infrared imaging. This image in the top is from the summer, and you can see in the summer there's cooler groundwater seep entering a surface water body, whereas in the winter the warmer, more buoyant surface water or the groundwater inflows are basically the inverse. We can see warmer groundwater inflows coming in relative to the colder surface water bodies in the winter time. So depending on the season, we can use thermal infrared imaging to begin to understand. So we can take that EM data. We can then go in with the thermal infrared at those areas that were suspected and see if we can confirm that, yes, the EM data was finding groundwater inputs. And then the next level of investigation, we can use fiber optic distributed temperature systems, where we can lay a fiber optic cable down in the stream. We can measure that temperature over time. And in this case, you can see here's a spring discharge coming in along the fiber, which has a lower temperature than the data, than the river water. We can also display the fiber in a grid and measure sort of in a more 2D sense. We can measure here in this case we had a lower temperature non-flowing tributary at this particular site. My time is going through pretty fast. So how does DTS measures? I'm not going to get into this because of the time, but basically we just send out a light down the fiber, and using this Raman backscatters analyzed to estimate the temperature along the cable. This is sort of a schematic that shows the light being transmitted down the cable. We know the location of the cable and that temperature-dependent backscatter that comes through. We can then plot, and here's some examples on the. Actually, these are the same streams that I showed the EM data. We can see during the day it's much warmer. At night it's much cooler. These are some of the data. And you can see where the temperature throughout these different time scales, you can see it cools off at night, increases during the day. What we do is we do a little statistics on the data, and based on the standard deviation, we can see potential seepage zones. We can correlate that with the EM data or other geophysical data and geolocate that to try to look at different methods with converging lines of evidence to try to understand where acid mine drainage might be entering. So in summary, hopefully I convinced you that we need to match the geophysical method with our objectives, the scale of investigation. We use more than one method to try to understand what's going on in the subsurface, and this is all based on if there's a physical property contrast or not. And that geophysical response is a function of the geology, the hydrogeology, the biology, and the chemistry, and how all those things interact. Like if the pH lowers, it might increase the TDS of the pore fluid and result in an increased conductivity of the groundwater. So with that, I will stop and hopefully have some time to answer a question or two. And those are all the folks that have helped out in a lot of the content in this talk.
Thanks, Dale. That was a great presentation, and it generated quite a bit of interest, a lot of it very specific detail. We had a number of folks who were interested in a little more information on the depth of investigation for some of the tools, in particular the depth of investigation for GPR, self-potential, and the seismic reflection and refraction. Could you say a few words about each one of those?
Sure. So GPR is really site-dependent and frequency-dependent on which antenna you're going to use. So if the site has a lot of clays at the surface, and specifically clays that have a high cation exchange capacity, they're going to absorb a lot of that radar energy, so you're not going to get a lot of energy into the subsurface and learn about the distribution of the electrical properties in the subsurface. If you don't have clays, then you can pretty much govern your depth of investigation with GPR based on the frequency of the antenna that you use, where the lower the frequency of the antenna, the deeper you see, but you suffer resolution. So if you're interested in deep images of geologic structure, you can use a lower frequency antenna. If you are interested in more of the shallow, higher resolution, you can use a higher frequency antenna. The seismic work, you can really see quite deep. I mean, seismic is the traditional geophysical method that oil companies use to see miles into the earth. So you can really design your seismic exploration to see very shallow with high resolution or very, very deep, depending on the objectives of your site. You can just tailor your method, your source, and your acquisition parameter based on that depth of investigation. And SP, self-potential, was traditionally used for big porphyry deposit mineral exploration. So again, it can be based on your acquisition. If you have you use special non-polarizing electrodes to measure the self-potential of the earth, and you can move those electrodes really far apart to get to measure a larger volume of the earth, which effectively is measuring something deeper. And then again, if you're more interested in something closer to the surface, you just bring those electrodes closer together, and you're measuring that voltage drop of a smaller volume of earth that's not quite as deep. So there are some acquisition methods or parameters you can alter to target your depth of investigation, but then there's also the physical properties of the earth, depending on the method you use, which is going to influence or limit your depth of penetration, like with GPR.
All right. Well, thank you, Dale. I know that there are some other questions that folks have out there. I'd like to move on to make sure we have plenty of time for the other speakers. Those of you who have submitted questions, we will try to address them. And Gene, correct me if I'm wrong here, but there is an opportunity for us to respond to some of these questions since we do have them logged in.
That's exactly correct. We can continue to capture those questions, and then we'll work on getting responses later on.
All right, great. So our next speaker, as I mentioned, is Robert Ford. Are you on the line? You ready to go?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead and take it.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to follow on with part of the subject that Dale introduced in terms of looking at trying to find groundwater impacts and where they may daylight into surface water bodies. I'll focus more on once you've found locations of interaction of concern with regard to an upgrade in or upland groundwater plume, looking at the quantity of contaminated groundwater and how that water exchange process may vary in time and influence contaminant fate and transport within the surface water body. So in my presentation, I'll cover three areas. One, I'll provide some context for evaluating water and contaminant flux from upland groundwater to downgradient surface water bodies, and this is in terms of developing a conceptual site model that will ultimately inform decisions or designs for reclamation at a given site. The next section, I'll spend time focusing on the hydraulic pathway and understanding ways of understanding the quantity and direction of water exchange between the groundwater aquifer and the surface water body. And then end up by discussing using a case study to talk about some factors that might control contaminant flux to the surface water body, either directly from groundwater discharge or impacts to the sediments within that surface water body. With regard to the conceptual site model, there are several things that we want to try to understand with regard to interaction between groundwater and surface water. Ultimately, water flux of groundwater and surface water at that interface is going to govern the types of processes that are controlling contaminant fate at that location. The dominant chemical processes will be governed by the mass of contaminant and reactive constituents delivered to and mixed at this interface. So there could be constituents that are derived directly from that plume, but we also have to keep aware of the chemical contribution from the local geology itself and how that may play a role in terms of contaminant fate at the groundwater surface water interface. And ultimately, the net result of the processes will likely vary in time, seasonally, and space, geology, as Dale was alluding to in his presentation. Here's a simple conceptual diagram that shows a cross-section through a shallow aquifer, showing an upland area of interest. This is where we might have source areas, either tailings piles or other contaminant releases from the closed mining operation or tailings operation. And then looking down gradient to potentially impact the surface water body and trying to understand, is there a hydraulic connection between these two locations, and do I need to be concerned about it in terms of contaminant load to the surface water body as well as the contaminant fate ultimately as after it reaches that surface water body. For the site conceptual site model, with a focus on site hydrology, there are several questions that we want to try to address in terms of a location where we've identified contaminant plume or potential for contaminant plume discharge. One, the first, does it exist? Do we have a complete transport pathway from the upland system to the surface water body? Is it continuous or is it episodic? Does it change with season and water flows in that surface water body or in the local groundwater system? And when it is connected, does the direction of water exchange vary? Do we have periods where we may have groundwater discharge to the surface water body, and then in other periods where that surface water body is actually recharging the aquifer? Ultimately, these questions need to be addressed in terms of understanding the timing and location of contaminant discharge and the impact it might have on either the ecosystem or transport within that surface water body. Following on with the conceptual site model, here are a couple of diagrams to illustrate a system in which the surface water body is a stream. In the upper panel, looking at a vertical cross-section or slice through the shallow aquifer in that surface water body, and to point out that the stream morphology and the site topography actually influences what the local flow field for that groundwater system will look like in space and time relative to what that river or stream will see. In the bottom panel, we look looking from an aerial image down onto the land surface, and again, we see that the local flow system shown by the small arrows that are changing directions adjacent to the stream channel, how that varies in space and can vary in time. So we may need to understand the spatial variability relative to understanding the potential impact of that plume as well as changes that may made upgradient and how that may interact with this particular flow system. We know that the surface water body is a continually fluctuating type system. If it's a stream, if you've got a static system like a pond or a lake or a reservoir, that may be less dynamic. And often we consider groundwater as a relatively static system, but as you get closer to that surface water body, it becomes a lot less static. There's an interplay between the regional groundwater system and that stream or that surface water body. And from that perspective, it's typically not sufficient to go out in points in time and to collect data and truly understand that. This is where we need to rely more on instrumented and continuously logged monitoring locations. Ultimately, effective CSM for this type of setting depends on understanding contaminant transport from the source area to the surface water body and specifically the dynamics at that groundwater surface water interface. The one thing that we need to be aware of, if there are non-detects in that surface water body, either in the surface water or sediments, it could mean that there is not a complete pathway or the contaminated groundwater is not reaching the surface water body, but it also may mean that we're not in the right location and we're not in the flow path. And that's where, hearkening back to what Dale was talking about, we really need to understand where are the most likely locations within the subsurface for that groundwater plume to flow to and reach that surface water body. So let's talk about how we can measure that water exchange process in space and time. Here again is one of the diagrams I used showed previously, an aerial view of a stream. I've expanded the view so that you see with the large black areas sort of the regional groundwater flow system that is impinging on that surface water body. The small arrows show the transition zone or the hyperaic zone if we're talking about streams and rivers and how there may be spatial differences in where we've got recharge to the aquifer or discharge to that stream channel or surface water body. And so in the next slides, I'll focus on this area of discharge, which presumably if we know that the contaminated plume is reaching this is where we're going to be looking for contamination impacts in the surface water body. There are a number of devices that can be deployed. A lot of the work that we've done, which typically is focused on Superfund sites or abandoned mine, where we're talking about closed mine sites and going in and trying to do restoration activities. There are a number of devices, hand-deployed devices that we use to get a relatively localized view. Once we have a good sense from some of the measurements that Dale and David were describing, where we might have a good sense spatially where these impact locations are occurring. We can go in and focus on getting a better, more complete understanding on the water exchange dynamics and how that may impact both existing conditions within the surface water body and how that surface water body might recover if we do upland or upgradient remedial activities for the groundwater plume. Number of hand-deployed devices such as shallow piezometers that are basically a steel pipe with a screened interval that you can drive to fairly shallow depths. So there will be limitations to where these can be hand-deployed to depths. Our experience, you can reasonably, in unconsolidated formations, get to depths of 5 to 10 feet. Within the river channel, the symbol PS is a piezometer of the same kind of construction to which we've attached basically a PVC pipe that's called a stilling well. And this is a location where we can measure depth from a common elevation to both the groundwater system as well as the surface water body and start looking at vertical gradients that would be supporting flow either up or down within that portion of the stream. The yellow triangle is for a temperature profiler where we follow up on the use of temperature as a tracer that Dale was talking about, where we can actually deploy temperature sensors into the sediments, collect data, and then interpret that data to then calculate and estimate the magnitude and direction of water exchange flux. And then systems such as a permeometer, hand-deployed permeometer, which is basically a thin-walled pipe that we shove into the sediments and do tests such as falling head tests where we can look at how much that sediment will support water exchange. In all of these, we can deploy logging sensors so that we can see variations over time. And for stream systems and dynamic systems, this becomes a critical aspect to the data collection process. With piezometers like this, where we can survey a relative common elevation, We can then use these to understand what the horizontal gradient, either towards or away from that surface water body, and that helps us inform understanding of contaminant flux or discharge. Here are some photographs of some of these tools being deployed in streams or pond systems. And as you can see, there's nothing fancy here. Really, the fancy part of these instrumentation are the logging devices, either continuously logging pressure transducers or temperature logging devices that are on the orders in terms of costs of hundreds of dollars, so not terribly expensive. They're reusable. They have long lifetimes on the order of 5 to 10 years. So over time, they become a really cost-effective option to gather that time-dependent data that becomes critical to understanding the dynamics of the system. And ultimately, the goal here is to develop an integrated knowledge where we're looking for horizontal gradient, vertical gradient data that tells us where water should be flowing across the interface. We might use that to estimate what the flux may be. We can use sediment temperatures to then more directly get estimates of water flux in the vertical direction and see how that varies in space and time. These devices, you can imagine, can be pulled and moved to other locations, or they're fairly inexpensive so that you can monitor several locations within a surface water body. This is the basis for comprehending processes controlling contaminant flux and fate at the groundwater interface. And the baseline analysis of the system is important and provides the basis for interpreting whether remedial actions we're taking up gradient are having positive effects, negative effects, or neutral effects on recovery in that surface water body. The organic contaminant itself plays a role in this, and that the properties of that contaminant will influence whether it is mobile all the way into that surface water body or whether it gets captured within the sediments. So the inherent properties of that contaminant are important in terms of to what degree it may precipitate or adsorb. Changes in chemical speciation may influence these processes. And so what we know about this interface zone is that it's an area where there are major changes in chemistry. So not only do we need to understand the dynamics of the water flow, but we need to characterize this gradient, chemical gradient, and determine what effect that might have on contaminant fate and transport. Ultimately, contaminants may get sequestered in the sediments, but the contaminant property will dictate whether or not that remains stable. It can become, those sediments can become a secondary source to that surface water body. And as an example here, this diagram shows a cross-section through a hypothetical system in which on the right we have a contaminated groundwater plume with arsenic and reduced iron transporting through the sediment interval shown with this hatched area into a surface water body. The degree to which that arsenic will penetrate into the surface water body will be dictated to some extent on the amount of dissolved oxygen and its penetration into the sediments. We're in shallow portions of the surface water body, we may get full sequestration within the sediments, but in deeper portions, there may be an unhindered transport in the surface water body. And so that's where knowing some properties of the contaminant plume as well as the contaminants itself become important in integrating that with what we understand about flow dynamics. In the next series of slides, I'll use a case study to illustrate data collection with some of these instruments and specifically looking at the interpretation and use of those data to understand the dynamics and locations of contaminant flux and the recovery with the installation of an upgradient remedy. This is a system where there's a groundwater plume discharging towards a small lake called Plowshop Pond. The focus is on this relatively isolated area called Red Cove. The red arrows show the magnitude, in this case, of arsenic discharge over time into this cove, and you can see that it's spatially distributed with a primary focus on this southwest edge of the cove here. Here's a visual depiction of what that cove looked like while there was still contaminated plume discharge. So this harkened back to that hypothetical situation that I described earlier where we've got a lot of reduced iron that is being transported until it hits that surface water body and encounters oxygen. And as David was talking about, you get these orangish-red precipitates that are different forms of iron oxides. In this case, this is probably ferric hydrate is the primary one because of the pH of the system. And so you can see the impact of the surface water body. I will point out that there's still a lot of aquatic plant growth in here, and that becomes a factor later in terms of understanding post-remedy impacts in the system or recovery. Ultimately, we use the different methods that I described earlier to map out discharge, water flux discharge into that surface water body, the cove itself, piezometers within the surface water body, seepage meters, other tools, the temperature profilers to map out sediment flux or water flux, discharge flux into the surface water body, which was important to understand the distribution of contaminated sediments. We found windows of primary plume discharge, where the plume basically discharged in unhindered manner for the most part, leading to elevated concentrations within the water column of that surface water body. And then sediments in other areas, we saw less water discharge, but we saw sediments a fairly uniform distribution of contaminant sedimentation. And ultimately, what we found is that those sediments were not stable at different periods of the year, and that we got recycling and redissolution, and so it became, those sediments became a secondary load to that surface water body. And it was important to understand that and understand where that those different processes were controlling arsenic fate in that system throughout that cove. Here's a diagram here where I'm going to start talking about looking at mass flux measurements as a both pre-remedy site characterization tool to understand impacts and then post-remedy. This same diagram I showed earlier showing the contaminant discharge to the surface water body. The remedy that was selected was the installation of a subsurface hydraulic barrier to divert the plume away from this cove into an area towards an extraction system down gradient. In the diagram showing the data here as a function of time and year from 2006 to about 2019, so close to the present. On the scale here, or the data I'm presenting, the open squares are groundwater flux. So this is just water flux. You can see it varies throughout time over the year. The green dashed line shows when that hydraulic barrier was put in place so that we see on average there was a reduction of flux originating from this portion of the aquifer here towards the cove. The red dots are when we have taken arsenic concentrations measured in the aquifer, combined that with the flux data to calculate a contaminant flux, and you can see with the installation of that barrier that we're seeing recovery within this shallow portion of the aquifer that's down gradient of where that hydraulic barrier was installed. We move down out into the surface water body. We use temperature profiling to map out changes in water flux, seepage flux, into the surface water body. The top graph, orange dots, show calculated flux prior to the installation of that hydraulic barrier, and the green dots show post-installation measured flux for a period of 3 months at 2 years. And you can see that there's a visible difference and a quantifiable difference in reduction in flux. Then in the bottom graph, we're looking at water flux over the entire monitoring period from 2008 to 2017, where the various dots show measurements either within the aquifer or within the cove itself based on sediment temperature data. And the trend lines drawn through these series of dots reflect that there is a distinct reduction in water flux to the system. In this last diagram, data slide, I show then the pattern of arsenic flux over time, where the red trace, continuous trace, is that interpolated groundwater arsenic flux over time, again showing that even though there's variability, that there's a consistent reduction after installation of the hydraulic barrier. This gray line shows there was, I didn't mention prior, but there was also a sediment removal of the existing contaminated sediments after the hydraulic barrier was put in place. The gray diamonds then show direct, separate, independent measurements within the cove in which we're measuring seepage flux as well as pore water concentrations to calculate a flux into that surface water body. And again, you see that there was a significant and quantifiable difference responding to this remediation. Here's sort of the outcome of this, again showing the before picture of the impact to the surface water body in the upper left-hand picture. And then on the bottom is the recovery. This is after. This is what the system looks like today, following both the hydraulic barrier installation as well as the sediment removal. And whereas there was limited indications of aquatic species activity, we started seeing evidence of actually fish hatching beds that have continued immediately following the remedy and has continued. We see occasional spikes in the surface water arsenic concentrations, but that is a result of some recontamination that has occurred to the sediments because we didn't eliminate all of the plume at the hydraulic barrier, so there is an orphan plume that's winding its way through the system. However, those impacts are much more limited and are not negatively influencing the recovery of the aquatic system. Closing remarks, methods to assess groundwater flow and seepage flux are relatively easy to implement and provide flexibility to monitor the groundwater surface water interface. At least those are some of the tools I've shown here. Knowledge of that water flux dynamics is important to understand what processes are controlling contaminant fate. Not only the amount of plume that's being discharged, but the directions of that water exchange over time and space throughout the watershed. And comprehensive of this baseline contaminant flux, characterizing that baseline is important ultimately to then interpreting, is the upland remedy I put in place reaping beneficial results for that aquatic system? And I thank you for your attention. A couple of questions that I have for you to consider. I've focused on hand deployable instrumentation that are cheap and inexpensive and fairly easy to install. These are not permanent devices. I'm curious to see from the audience, do they see benefit in use of these, and what limitations do you see? And then in terms of the focus on arsenic and iron chemistry for this type of setting, are there other plume chemistries that are of interest to the audience? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Robert. So while we wait for that question to come up, we encourage folks to type in their questions. But in the meantime, Robert, I had a question. In your intro remarks and also in many of the case studies, you mentioned and you showed these temporal changes in contaminant flux. So the first thing I thought of was, boy, you know, I measure like twice a year at my site. How do I know if we're going to have these temporal fluxes more times throughout the year? Can you expand on some of the mechanisms that might drive these temporal changes in contaminant flux and how common that is to see at sites?
Sure. So with regard to the monitoring effort, I would say that monitoring the hydrologic variations is relatively easy to address. Looking at the chemical variations is less easy, although you can use surrogates. One of which Dale referred to, such as specific conductivity, might be a plume indicator. There are long-term monitoring devices that can be used to monitor over extended periods of time where you might not be able to be physically present collecting samples. And the variations that occur, it's going to be a function of what's happening in the up-gradient groundwater system. So different periods of the year where you might have active recharge to the system versus little to no active recharge is going to affect the amount of either leaching through surface impoundments and leaching down into that shallow water table, groundwater system, as well as it may influence the magnitude and direction of groundwater flux. And then, again, transitioning down to the surface water body, what's happening, you know, the season of the year, the groundwater system, what's happening upland, will certainly influence what's happening at that groundwater surface water interface, but the surface water body itself may have a direct and significant impact on water exchange and therefore contaminant exchange. Again, with different periods of years where you've got a lot of infiltration occurring, you're expecting infiltration of dissolved oxygen might be occurring, so you may be changing the plume chemistry because of that. And there may be other periods where you're getting very little dissolved oxygen penetration down and down to the water table. So those are the kinds of processes that we might miss and misunderstand if we're only going out for very limited periods of time throughout the year. It's hard to collect that detailed data on a continuous approach, but that's where we can do some of these surrogate measurements, looking at hydrology, looking at indicators such as specific conductivity with logging sensors that may help us fill those data gaps and develop a better understanding of the dynamics of the system.
All right. Well, thank you. And just a reminder to everyone, feel free to reply to these questions using the Q&A window on your screen. Just one really quick question from a participant. So in your example at Red Cove, how did you measure, how did you determine the flux measurement there? Did you use piezometers, water level differences, or did you use some other methodology to look at flux, to quantify the flux there?
Okay, we used multiple methods. So we did use piezometers, so looking at vertical gradient, which you can estimate a specific discharge or a Darcy flux. We did use actual physical seepage meters at deployed at different locations at different points in time. And then that's where we really put more focus on using sediment temperature profile measurements. And this technique is used by many, many folks and has been around for quite a period of time. And you can use those temperature measurements and some analytical solutions and calculation tools that have been developed by multiple parties, including USGS and others, to calculate what the magnitude of that water flux is at that point by inference based on the temperature profile that you're measuring. So there are multiple techniques that can be used. Basically, I would recommend use every technique you can and can afford to use, just like Dale was talking about using multiple techniques and making sure that you get a converging consensus about interpretation of what's going on. But those are the types of tools that we use there.
All right. Well, great. Thank you very much. So to make sure we have plenty of time for our final speaker, I appreciate your time, and we'd like to transition over now to our final speaker, Kirk Shekel, who will take us down to the microscopic level and talk about some isotopic methods. Kirk.
Great. Thank you. Can you hear me?
I certainly can.
Okay, great. So I'll skip over this slide. You guys have heard the presentation or the title already, and let's get right into this. So the first point I want to make is when we're considering source attribution and comparing that to risk exposure, we really need to look at these two items as two distinct issues. And I'm sure many of you on the call are already well aware of this. In terms of source attribution, I'm going to discuss today a technique for measuring lead isotopes. And what we're trying to do in this situation is identify where is the lead coming from. And by measuring lead isotopes, and there's four that we commonly can measure. A lot of people typically measure at least three, and we're looking at these ratios, and those signatures are very, very distinct, and I really kind of refer to it as the genetics of lead, what we're trying to identify in these situations. So if we have a source material and we know the lead isotopic signature for that, we can compare it to background samples as well as suspected impacted samples from a site. And hopefully there's a tie-in, there's a relationship there that can say, okay, the source material is directly tied to these impacted samples, or in some cases we find out that the suspected source material has nothing to do with the contamination within a certain area. And that could be a way to eliminate one way of measuring impact. The important thing to realize with isotopic ratios is that they, within our lifetime, they're not going to change. The half-lives of these materials are generally billions of years, so we don't need to worry about isotopic ratios changing. And these isotopic ratios vary dramatically across the country where you have different ore bodies that were laid down, as well as around the world. Now, on the other side of this, in terms of risk exposure, we're specifically looking at lead speciation, how the form of lead drives risk. And we know that the solubility of specific lead minerals or adsorption phases, for example, will have significant variations in bioavailability, which relates back to risk. We also know, too, that the form of lead is environmentally driven, so it can change over time. So if you have an environment that's maybe the pH is relatively high, you see formation of lead carbonates, and all of a sudden some event comes across that causes the pH to drop, and you see dissolution of the lead carbonate and then redistribution to adsorption onto clay minerals or organic matter or reprecipitation of something else. That's where that risk exposure shows that you can observe changes over time, and you really have to look at this as a fingerprinting process that to match up where those phases are and how they're being measured and how those relate to risk exposure. So the best case scenario I can show for this, looking at trying to relate the difference between isotopes or the genetics of material versus the speciation, is if you have a house that has lead-based paint on it, and the soil below that windowsill has lead-based paint chips falling onto it, we may observe transformations in that soil over time. So the lead oxide or the lead carbonate that's originally in that paint material may succumb to maybe an acidic soil environment where you see redistribution of lead to lead sulfate or lead absorbing onto organic matter within the grass of that soil matrix. Now, just from that fact, we know then here the speciation of lead that's originally in the paint is no longer now in the soil environment. So we can see how speciation changed. However, the isotopic ratio of lead in that paint is going to be the same isotopic ratio of that when it's transformed in that soil environment to a different phase. So we can make a direct link between the source of lead coming from the house into the soil, but speciation doesn't really tell us where that source of material came from due to those changes. Now, one of the ways that we look at changes in lead speciation is synchrotron spectroscopy. Shown here is the, let me get the pointer. There it is. Shown here is the advanced photon source at Argonne National Lab. It's outside the city of Chicago. Downtown Chicago is right over here. It's a very large, impressive facility at a DOE facility. It's about a kilometer in circumference. These are actually cars in the parking lot to give you a perspective of the size of this facility. And what we can do at this facility is a variety of different and distinct techniques, such as X-ray fluorescence, which allows us to do chemical composition, mapping, and quantification. So in this case, a brighter color represents a higher concentration. We can look at distribution of arsenic in a soil sample. X-ray absorption spectroscopy is really kind of the workhorse technique that we utilize for chemical speciation. It can help us identify oxidation state, coordination environment, and identify neighboring atoms. And a good example of that is, in this case, if we do our XRF mapping, we can go back and then find a spot of interest, collect a spectra, and then determine that perhaps at this point that we have copper one present that's bound to two chlorine atoms, so we can identify bond distances. And that's getting really down to the nitty-gritty of it. But we can also do a number of other related techniques, such as linear combination fitting, as a fingerprinting approach if we have known standards of chemicals and compare that to the unknown sample that we're collecting. A couple other techniques in this process, we can do surface scattering. And another one is microtomography, which is basically a CAT scan of material. And shown here is an example of arsenic accumulation on the iron plaque around a cattail root. Just as an example. Again, X-ray absorption spectroscopy is the technique that we're utilizing. We have the APS synchrotron facility. We have a monochromator that allows us to tune energy. That's the uniqueness of this facility. So by tuning the energy, we can take energy steps and eventually collect a spectra where we have energy go up. And this is all related to the electronic structure of a particular element. So we can measure the intensity of the beam before it interacts with the sample, and then as the beam's interacting with the sample, other detectors to measure the difference between before and after. Now, this is a nice technique. Again, the position of these peaks, for example, for a specific element helps us identify oxidation state. Some of these extra squiggly lines over here help us identify relationship to other elements that are present around an element of interest. And in many cases, lead is our example. We can look at fairly low concentrations, which really isn't a problem for us because we're typically always looking at very contaminated sites. But a big advantage of this technique, too, is that we can look at natural samples in situ. So there's no need to put the sample under vacuum. There's no need to dry it. We can literally collect the sample from the field and take it directly to the facility and collect data. Shown here are some example spectra of lead, common lead minerals or chemicals that we interact with. So you can see position changes and peaks that are indicative. And just a quick look by many of you that probably have never seen this technique before, you're probably thinking these all look like squiggly lines. But as one gets more experienced with it, you can start to identify key differences. For example, lead oxide up here at the top has a very distinct structure. It's a very unique structure for a lead mineral. But we also have up here in the green and purple are two different lead carbonates, and you can see differences. There's like a shoulder for this hydrocerussite, as well as here that doesn't show up in traditional cerussite, and as well as the peak positions are slightly different. So these are all indicators for us to identify when we measure a spectra for a contaminated sample, then to compare it to these known reference materials to be able to parse out the distribution and concentration of lead species that are present in that particular sample. Now, moving on to source attribution, here we're trying to figure out where lead came from, okay, or where the contamination came from. Now, if every site was like this, it'd be wonderful. If we have a contaminated source here that's contributing into the stream, and we measure samples downstream, and we compare it to samples upstream, and we find that the enrichment and concentration and lead isotopes in this particular sample matches the source, voila, that's the source. And that's what we're trying to do. Now, not every site is that simple, and it gets very complex. But first, before we go on to that, a case study at the end, just quickly a little bit of isotope chemistry. Isotopes are variants of a particular chemical element, which differ only in neutron number with the same number of protons. So you've probably heard of carbon-12, carbon-14, tritium, deuterium, are all isotopes. And for lead, we can then encounter similar situations. But the neutrons, these differences in neutrons are very, very important, but they serve a purpose of keeping the atom stable, is essentially what they're trying to do. But the numbers of them can vary a bit, and that allows us to identify some distinct differences in these concentrations as well as distribution. So for lead, we can measure lead 204, 206, 207, and 208. Lead 204 is the only stable form of lead, but its composition in the Earth's crust is only 1.4%. So you have to have a pretty high-end instrument in order to measure it. Typically, most people can measure lead 206, 207, and 208. And these concentrations or distributions are about 25% each for lead 206 and 207, and lead 208 makes up about 50% of lead composition. And so once we measure these materials, a very simple process, it's like digesting a sample for an ICP or an AA analysis, but we take a portion of it and we're sending it through an ICP mass spectrometer based system. And then we can start looking at relationships, and we can plot out lead 206 divided by 208 divided by 206 versus lead 207 divided by lead 206. And you start to see relationships, groupings, and trends of how these isotopic signatures lay out. Very quickly, here are the decomposition reactions of the radiogenic lead isotopes that we have present. And in order for lead 206 that we identify, it's usually as a result of the breakdown of uranium-238. And this is not a direct path. There's many, many steps from uranium breaking down before we get finally to lead 206. But this whole process will take almost 4 billion years. Same for uranium-207, the breakdown of uranium-235, and thorium-232 results in lead-208. So we have very long half-lives, so that way we can identify an ore body in Missouri, how different it is from an ore body in Idaho or in Canada, for example. And here are some of those examples. This is looking at the lead-206-207 distribution. We're looking at means. And just to give you a perspective, let's look at leaded gasoline in traditional leaded gasoline from Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. In Mexico, that isotopic ratio is 1.2. It drops significantly for Canada, and the U.S. falls right in between it. And this is all the result of the ore or the factory that was producing tetraethyl lead for DuPont at the time used very specific ore bodies. In fact, in many urban areas, if we were to go and measure lead isotopic ratios at a traditional background site, almost inevitably it'll come back at this 1.18 value. And if we look at ores, for example, at Bunker Hill, Idaho, the average lead 206-207 signature is 1.09. And if we move into Missouri, that lead isotopic ratio jumps significantly to 1.33. Now, you may think these are not significant changes, but they're quite dramatic when we start looking at these laid out in comparison to other lead isotopic ratios. And the way we measure this, and in fact, I took advantage of an opportunity to collaborate with USGS, Mike Preble there, using a multi-collector inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer. And this is the high end. This is the Cadillac version. This allows us to measure lead 204. And so it's a fairly simple process, as I mentioned. If you're doing like a total digestion to measure total lead or other elements, it's just saving a portion of that extractant. And doing this measurement. And it's much, much higher sensitivity, so it allows a fairly easy and convenient way to look at lead isotopes. And of course, there's a little bit of a cost in terms of conducting these types of study versus traditional ICP measurement. So here's the setup. You have a traditional ICP system. We're feeding into this line. And we eventually come to a magnetic phase that starts to separate out the different isotopes and come down into this multi-collector. And so heavier elements tend to take an outer track, whereas lighter isotopes will take an inner track. And this allows us to separate them out, and then we can measure these based on a concentration basis. All right, so to kind of close up this talk, I'm going to give a case study of the Big River mine tailings, specifically impacted by the St. Joe Mineral Corporation site. And this is a former mining area known as Old Lead Belt in Missouri. It's about 70 miles south of St. Louis. There's 8 very large mine waste piles in this rural area, covering approximately 110 square miles. A significant event happened in 1977 where approximately 50,000 cubic yards of tailings sloughed into the Big River and move downstream, and there's flooding events pretty common, especially in the spring in this area, that will redistribute contaminated sediment up into the floodplain soils. Also in this area is a barite mine in Washington County. I'll show a map here in a second. And it was suspected or suggested as being a secondary source of lead in the Big River, and so we had to investigate that. And that's what the challenge came here is, was lead totally in the Big River, totally coming from the St. Joe Mineral Corporation, or was it a combination or contribution from other sources? Now, the significance of the Big River is that it also flows through Jefferson County and deposits eventually into the Merrimack River and then finally into the Mississippi River. So there's an ecological impact of trying to treat and understand the contamination at this site as well. So shown here are lead concentrations in soils. St. Francis County, where the mine tails piles are, have relatively high concentrations. The legend over here shows you distributions up to 10,000. So we're measuring soil concentrations near the source piles. We measured concentrations upstream. That actually is a dot. If you can see it, it's quite small. So we looked at soil samples above, upstream, I guess, if you will, of the site. River flow goes this way. Here's the Big River and a couple smaller tributaries that feed into it. We collected sediment and soil samples, and they're mainly paired. So while these look like they're on the river, they're actually floodplain soil samples that were collected with adjacent sediment samples. So shown in this next slide is the sediment concentrations, which we can see is significantly high down here near the tailing piles. As we move downriver, we have variations. We do have a slight increase here, and if I recall from the regional person I talked to, that there was a sediment trap approach that was being done here, so we had accumulation of sediment material that resulted in that increase. But as we move down the river, before we get to the Merrimack, we see a decrease in concentration of lead in the sediment material relative to these high levels down here in St. Francis County. to follow this up, we also applied speciation. So it's shown here are distributions. We have a legend over here where we have plumbo-yarosite, anglesite, which is lead sulfate, lead carbonate, lead sulfide is galena, hydrocerasite, and then this light blue is adsorbed lead. So in the soil samples, we do have some variations down here near the tailing piles where we have a little bit of galena left. There's a significant portion of lead carbonate in this particular sample, but in some cases we do see a lot of that light blue color representative of lead absorbed, and we kind of grouped lead absorbed onto clay minerals and organic matter into that category. And as we move away from the source or the tailing piles here and downstream for these other soil samples, we see a predominance of adsorbed lead being present. And what this represents is on the risk side of things. We know adsorbed lead has a much higher bioavailability when ingested than galena, for example. So while concentration will be significantly higher here, the bioavailability of this particular sample is probably lower than samples down here with a much lower lead concentration. But bioavailability needs to then be placed in context of dose. So the higher concentration here, even though it's a lower bioavailability, may still result in a much higher dose of lead being absorbed. So again, this is for the soil samples. If we move over to the sediment samples, we see more of our traditional expectations of higher amounts of galena being present near the tailing pile areas. We start to see a conversion of galena into other forms of lead. And then as we move down river, it's a very shallow river that's not a very anoxic environment. We see the presence of adsorbed lead moving away from it. So this is a good example of, you know, if we measure speciation here, there's no way we could tie it to speciation back here at these tailing piles or even in some of these barite mining areas that we identified. So this is just an example of, you know, comparing source attribution to that risk side I was mentioning earlier. So lastly, in the second part of it, is looking at the lead isotopes. So we collected a good number of samples and sent forth to look at lead isotopic distribution. So here we're looking at the distribution of lead 206 divided by 207, plotted as a function of inverse temperatures or inverse concentration. So very high concentrations are located down here, very low out here. We have one kind of odd outlier. But what we notice is that we have groupings. So these red dots represent a group. We have kind of a split, but this could all be considered one grouping area. Typically, you're going to see a distribution falling off as in terms of a concentration like this. And the red dots represent source material or from the tailing piles from the St. Joe Mineral Corporation. And then the other red dots represent soil and sediment samples that were very similar in isotopic signature. To take and place this onto the map that we've been looking at, we'll give a distribution looking like this. So here are some of our tailing piles. There's a little bit of an outline of how large they are. Again, we're looking at samples that are upstream relative to the signature that we saw for the red samples in that previous figure. The barite mining area is in here for Washington County. There is a blue dot here, which is actually a holding pond for processing a barite ore material on land. And then, but as we move downstream, down Big River, soil samples that are near the river all have this red coating for being representative of a signature that's fairly similar to these tailing piles in St. Francis County. If we now move over to look at the sediment samples, the same is true. Collecting sediment samples upstream from the tailing piles have a distinctly different signature than the signature for lead 206-207 at the tailing piles. And in every other sediment sample that we collected going down Big River had a sediment signature of lead 206-207 exactly close to what the tailing piles were in St. Francis, which doesn't support the fact that the barite mining areas here were contributing to lead contamination going down the Big River. If we put all these samples together and kind of get a better picture, this is both soil and sediment. There's that barite holding pond, samples collected upstream. It's very clear to see that the signature that we measured at the source material is very in tune with the soil and sediment samples that we find up and down the Big River. So this gives us an indication, a way to look at source attribution to tie a particular source to contamination downstream. And we're very confident that this is a very helpful tool. And it may not be necessary in every situation for people to follow through, but just an example of how these techniques can be utilized. So in conclusion, I'm just going back to my second slide there. You know, look at source of lead contamination and the risk of lead contamination being two different distinct issues. We're looking at source attribution as a way to identify where the lead's coming from. We're looking at in terms of exposure risk, how lead speciation can help us understand what that risk is based off of speciation. And remember the fact, too, that lead isotopes, those ratios are not going to change significantly over time, whereas lead speciation, you may have some environmentally driven factors that will cause a change in lead speciation. And speciation, really think of it as a snapshot, if you will, of what the current state of lead exposure is. So with that, I know that was a lot of information very quickly, but I'll leave my name and email and phone number up here. If you'd like to contact me, I'd be happy to talk to you. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thanks, Kirk. That was a great presentation. And as we mentioned before, if y'all have questions, feel free to type them in. And if we can't get to them today, we'll try to have somebody get back to you. So, Kirk, I did have one question. I recently worked at a site where we suspected there might have been some material brought in from another mining district and processed at some of the mill sites because we saw some very different, very basic chemical constituent changes. If we wanted to use one of these techniques, how would we go about doing it? It seems like pretty specialized equipment.
It is specialized equipment, and so it should be kind of really as a last resort for following up, although lead isotopic measurements are becoming more and more common, much in line with sending samples out to do total concentrations at a contract lab. The synchrotron facility, actually, in actuality, access to that facility is free. It's a taxpayer-funded facility. You would have to submit a general user proposal, which kind of highlights what you want to accomplish, and it's judged on merit, and then beam time could be assigned to it to measure the samples. And then just the cost would be your travel and housing and per diem to attend and conduct the study. But it is a big learning curve, though, too. So you'd want to pair up, try to identify a beamline that'd be willing to work with you and collaborate and walk you through the process.
Sounds like you'd be the right person to talk to if we wanted to pursue something like that, though.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thanks very much. So it looks like our time is just about up. I think Gene has some closing comments and instructions.
All right, I do. And I do see a number of you have had other questions and comments coming in. And if we didn't get to them live during today's broadcast, please know that your questions have been captured, and we'll be sharing those with our organizers and presenters in hopes to get you a response later on. We do have the series carrying on all throughout the month of October, so I'll just remind you all, hopefully, that you can join us next week when we carry on with session number 2, where the topic will be emergency management. So if you have not yet signed up, I encourage you to head over to cluin.org and take a look at our training calendar and register for the other sessions in the series. Now, I will walk through just a few final reminders. Again, you'll find these events and more at cluin.org. You can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, where we also advertise these sessions as soon as they are available. If you are looking for copies of the presentation materials, we already have those available on the resources or links page. I've included a direct link to it right in the Q&A window. It's also available on the middle right of your screen. You can click the seminar resources link and then press the Browse To button to open it. Contact information for our presenters and organizers can also be found on that seminar homepage. So again, if you'd like to follow up with someone later on, you're certainly welcome to reach out to them. I would ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content that we covered as well as some of the techniques we employed in how we delivered our session today. Now, one of the most common questions I get in the background is if you can get a participation certificate for attending our sessions, and the answer is yes. So if you go to that feedback form and complete it, at the very bottom will be a box allowing you to check a box and certify you were here for the whole session. As soon as you submit that feedback form in, you will then have access to a certificate of participation with details about the session that you can then save or print out for your own records. If you happen to be in a group with a number of other people participating, guess what? Each of you can fill out that feedback form on your own, even if you didn't register individually. Just make sure that the person who did register sends you the link to the feedback form. Again, you'll find that on the right side of the screen. And then you can complete that at your own desk to get your own certificate. Now, for those of you looking for CLPs, it's a very specific type of points. We've had a few people asking for them for this session. You have all of the details you'll need for those CLP requests on the seminar homepage. So we have called them out here. You can also download this slide deck if you want to just copy and paste. But you'll simply need to know details such as the event name description, the type of training, which is classroom or online, our start and end dates for today, and you can request up to 1.5 points or CLPs for the session. We usually recommend, in addition to taking that participation certificate, but you also include copies of the presentation materials and your registration confirmation email if you had one to include as supporting documentation. If you need any additional assistance in documenting for CLPs, feel free to contact me directly at ballant.jean@epa.gov. So I will again thank the nearly 200 people who joined us from across the U.S. for today's live broadcast. Today's session was recorded, and we will automatically email all of you with a link to replay today's session. So if you thought that this was useful, you can also forward that information on to a coworker in hopes that they'll also find it useful. With that, I'd also like to thank all of our organizers from ORD, as well as our knowledgeable professional speakers who were able to take time out of their busy schedules to share their information and expertise with us. Again, I want to thank everybody who joined us, and we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.